Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Sound Health Options Show with Richard Talk To Me Guy. And Sherry will be here in the interview, but not live. She's taking a break after a week of class. So it'll be good for her to have a little time off after that. It's always, as you know, having been in class, wow. And first I'll start out by, you know, saying to everybody a happy Memorial Day. And this show, in my mind, is part of the conversation about maybe if there wasn't so much many lobbying in government that our veterans would be having better treatment. That's just in my opinion. But, yeah. Today's show is about Jack Abramoff. He's an ex-congressional lobbyist that used to make $20 million or more per year influence government in lobbying. He was very active, and then his career got suddenly halted with a 6-year jail sentence. He was put in jail for, you know, basically what he'd done and the corruption, well, that's my words, corruption, that he'd caused in Congress by gifting to congressmen and, you know, manipulating the government by manipulating congressmen and other agents around Congress to influence what happened. And he was making $20 million a year doing that. Well, it suddenly stopped. A jail sentence will do that. It'll really, it'll slow you way down. Actually, I'll read this part about Abramoff. He pleaded guilty in January 2006 to fraud, tax evasion, conspiracy to bribe public officials by showering them with gifts and inducing them to take official action on behalf of his lobbying group. The largesse included the use of luxury suites at Washington area sports arenas, free meals at upscale restaurants. Abramoff owned an all expense paid golf outing to Scotland. I mean, just, you know, that's just probably the tip of the iceberg if he's willing to claim that. Imagine, you know, everything else that occurred. Yeah, not exactly how government should be, again, in my opinion. So here is Sherry reviewing some of Jack Abramoff's statements and work. Happy Memorial Day, everybody.
We're going to be talking about how large pharmaceutical companies got in that position of being allowed to dictate what our health is going to look like, how they have a campaign that they're trying to advance to immunize all of us against diseases coming and going, and how they're also manipulating that information for their own financial benefit. I know that on this show, most of the time, I'm preaching to the choir, because most of you listeners are people who are already looking for ways to create a better world. And for me, I divide people up into two groups. People who want to give and help themselves and others, and people who want to take. And those people are not interested in others. They're only interested in what they can get for themselves. They don't care if you get hurt in the meantime. These people don't care about making anything, particularly our health and our planet and our environment. They don't care about making them better as long as they get more than their share. So I would like to see that stopped. Some of these people are just young souls and don't know any better. And so in that case, it's our responsibility to educate them. Some of the people know better, totally know that what they're doing is wrong, but they only see giving and caring people's fools as stupid do-gooders. Well, think about that for a minute. How does change happen? How does our species, our planet, our universe advance? It happens when we stop watching and accepting and we get up and do. So I would like to see this the year where we stop waiting and watching and we get up and do something. And I'm going to challenge you about that in the next hour and at the end of the show. And I'm going to ask you to take action in two ways. So today we're going to start with how lobbyists have taken over and stolen the government. And we're going to listen to the audio portion of an interview that Leslie Stahl did with Jack Evernoff, who has been spending his time in jail for corrupting congressmen. But, you know, he's doing the corrupting, but Congress people are allowing it. And I think you are going to be incredibly appalled by what's going on. You're also, if you can find this on the internet, and it's 60 Minutes and Jack Evernoff, watch it, because some of the people who are being interviewed and some of their facial expressions and reactions are just absolutely incredible. So keep in mind, as you listen to this, that drug companies are some of the biggest political lobbyists. And lobbying is one of the primary reasons why the drug companies are controlling nearly the entire health industry. Lobbying, by definition, conduct activities aimed at influencing public officials and especially members of a legislative body on legislation. This is big business, big pharma, doing what it does best, using its power and its money to manipulate and manage your health in a way that's going to increase their bottom line. It's been reported that the pharmaceutical industry spent $1.5 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars, lobbying Congress in the last decade. Okay, you're going to be hearing information that will demonstrate the use of fear and unconstitutional mandates in an effort to control you. So we're going to play this interview just in a second here. Let me get it queued up, and we will start.
Jack Evernoff may be the most notorious and crooked lobbyist of our time. He was at the center of a massive scandal of brazen corruption and influence peddling. As a Republican lobbyist starting in the mid-1990s, he became a master at showering gifts on lawmakers in return for their votes on legislation and tax breaks favorable to his clients. He was so good at it, he took home $20 million a year. It all came crashing down 5 years ago when Jack Evernoff pled guilty to corrupting public officials, tax evasion, and fraud, and served 3.5 years in prison. Today, he's a symbol of how money corrupts Washington. In our interview tonight, he opens up his playbook for the first time and explains exactly how he used his clients' money to buy powerful friends and influence legislation.
I was so far in it that I couldn't figure out where right and wrong was. I believed that I was among the top moral people in the business. I was totally blinded by what was going on.
Jack Evernoff was a whiz at influencing legislation, and one way he did that was to get his clients, like some Indian tribes, to make substantial campaign contributions to select members of Congress.
As I look back, it was effective. It certainly helped the people I was trying to help, both the clients and the Republicans at that time.
But even that was, you're now saying, was corrupt.
Yes.
Can you quantify how much it costs to corrupt a congressman?
I was actually thinking of writing a book, The Idiot's Guide to Buying a Congressman, as a way to put this all down. But first, I think most congressmen don't feel they're being bought. Most congressmen, I think, can, in their own mind, justify the system.
Rationalize.
Yeah. And by the way, we wanted as lobbyists for them to feel that way.
Evernoff would provide freebies and gifts,
right,
looking for favors for his clients in return. He'd lavish certain congressmen and senators with access to private jets and junkets to the world's great golf destinations like St. Andrews in Scotland, free meals at his own upscale Washington restaurant, and access to the best tickets to all the area's sporting events, including two skyboxes at Washington Redskins games.
I spent over $1 million a year on tickets to sporting events and concerts and whatnot at all the venues.
$1 million?
Yeah.
For the best seats?
The best seats. I had two people on my staff whose virtual full-time job was booking tickets. We were Ticketmaster for these guys. And
the congressman or senator could take his favorite people from his district?
Congressman or senator could take 24 of his favorite people from their district.
Was all that legal?
We would certainly try to make the activity legal if we could. At times we didn't care.
But the best way to get a congressional office to do his bidding, he says, was to offer a staffer a job that could triple his salary.
When we would become friendly with an office and they were important to us and the chief of staff was a competent person, I would say, or my staff would say to him or her at some point, you know, when you're done working on the Hill, we'd very much like you to consider coming to work for us. Now, the moment I said that to them, or any of our staff said that to them, that was it. We owned them. And what does that mean? Every request from our office, every request of our clients, everything that we want, they're going to do. And not only that, they're going to think of things we can't think of to do.
Jack Abramoff could sweet-talk a dog off a meat truck. That's how persuasive he was.
Neil Volz was one of the staffers Abramoff was talking about. He was chief of staff to Congressman Bob Ney, who as chairman of the House Administration Committee had considerable power to dispense favors. Abramoff targeted Volz and offered him a job.
You're the chief of staff of a powerful congressman, and Jack owns you, and you haven't even left working for the congressman.
Well, I have a distinct memory of, you know, negotiating with Jack at a hockey game. So we're, you know, just a few rows back. The crowd's going crazy. And Jack and I are having a business conversation. And, you know, I'm wrestling with how much I think I should get paid. And then 5 minutes later, he's asking me questions about some clients of his.
When you look back, was that the corrupting moment?
I think we were guilty of engaging in a corrupt relationship. So there were several corrupting moments. There isn't just one moment. There were many.
At the end of the day, most of the people that I encountered who worked on Capitol Hill wanted to come work on K Street, wanted to be lobbyists.
You're telling me this, the genius of figuring out you could own the office by offering a job to the chief of staff, say, I'm having two reactions. One is brilliant, and the other is I'm sick to my stomach.
Right, evil. Yeah, terrible.
Because it's hurting our country.
Absolutely, it's the worst thing that could happen. All parts
I'm
of
mad
the
at
system.
You.
I was mad
I'm
at
not
me.
Kidding. I'm
I
not
was
kidding.
Mad at me. Leslie, look, I did things, and I was involved in the system I should not have been in. I'm ashamed of the fact I was there. The very reason why now I'm speaking about it, and now I'm trying to do something in recompense, is the fact that I thought it was wrong of me to do it.
One of the offices he keyed on was that of his good friend, the majority leader Tom DeLay, eventually hiring his deputy chief of staff and his press secretary and going into business with DeLay's chief of staff.
Did you own his staff?
I was as close to his staff as to any staff. I had a very strong personal relationship with a lot of his staff.
How many congressional offices did you actually own?
We probably had very strong influence in 100 offices at a time.
Come on. 100 offices.
In those days, I would view that as a failure, because at least 335 offices that we didn't have strong influence in.
Did he own you?
I don't believe Jack Abramoff owned me. But were we involved in the culture of corruption together? Absolutely.
Former Republican Congressman Bob Ney was ambitious and looked at Abramoff as a way to build alliances with the White House and the majority leader.
I wanted to be Speaker of the House, and Jack Abramoff was the beautiful light of day for me to get to the person who I had had some conflicts with, Tom DeLay.
Abramoff began inviting Ney on golf trips, including one to Scotland, and to his restaurant Signatures, where Ney was given food and drinks on the house, a violation of the congressional gift limit laws. Ney says he was hardly the only one crossing the line.
But I will still tell you, at that point in time, in order to get a drink at Signatures, drinking food, Katie barred the door. She was wide open, two shotguns blaring.
After months of taking handouts, Ney was approached by Neil Volz, his former chief of staff, and by then a lobbyist for Abramoff.
I let you down there.
Volz asked Ney to insert some language into a reform bill that would give a backdoor license to an Indian casino owned by one of Abramoff's clients. You often hear about lobbyists getting special secret deals for their clients like this. It's an insidious technique that Abramoff perfected.
So what we did was we crafted language that was so obscure, so confusing, so uninformative, but so precise to change the U.S. Code.
Here's what you tried to get
right, tacked
on to this reform bill.
Yep.
Public Law 100-89 is amended by striking Section 207, paren, 101, stat, period, 668, comma, 672, close paren.
Right. Now, isn't that obvious what that means? It was perfect. It was perfect.
So that's what you tried to get inserted.
Yes.
And that was going to provide for a casino.
Yes.
And who on earth is going to know that?
No one except the chairman of the committees.
Who stuck it in there.
Yes.
And that's one of the things you used to do.
Yes.
And it was deliberately written like that.
Precisely. Yes.
And that's done a lot.
Members don't read the bill.
You didn't even know what it was for.
I had no idea. And then when we got the written language...
Why didn't you know what it was for? That
I didn't care.
Oh.
It was a great big shell game, and I was in the middle of it, whether, you know, knowing or not. I was dumb enough to not say, what's this thing do?
Ney would eventually serve 17 months in federal prison, the only congressman who was ever charged in the scandal. But Abramoff says there were many other members that did his bidding that could have been charged. Was buying favors from lawmakers easy?
I think people are under the impression that the corruption only involves somebody handing over a check and getting a favor. And that's not the case. The corruption, the bribery, call it.
Okay.
Because ultimately that's what it is. That's what the whole system is.
The whole system's bribery?
In my view, I'm talking about giving a gift to somebody who makes a decision on behalf of the public. At the end of the day, that's really what bribery is. But it is done every day, and is still being done. The truth is there are very few members who I could even name or could think of who didn't at some level participate in that.
Abramoff prided himself on being a man who did good.
Let him get in, will you?
He was devoutly religious and exorbitantly charitable. He says he gave away 80% of his earnings. When he fell from grace, his reputation was in tatters because it was not just that he had corrupted Congress. It was found he had cheated his clients like the Indian tribes.
Most of the money I made, I gave away to either communal or charitable causes. So I thought I was one of the most moral lobbyists out there.
Things began to unravel for Abramoff when the Washington Post published a largely unflattering portrait of him in 2004, reporting that he charged his clients 10 times more than any other lobbyist in town.
My first response was, what's the big deal? I don't understand what this is about. Of course, this is what lobbyists do.
What he didn't understand was the part that said he and a former aide to Tom DeLay had overbilled four of his Indian casino clients by $45 million. In the end, he was brought up on federal charges of tax evasion and ripping off Indian tribes. On the day he went to court and pled guilty, Abramoff looked grim. The judge sentenced him to 4 years. I really think what you were doing was subverting the essence of our system.
Absolutely right. But our system is flawed and has to be fixed. Human beings populate our system. Human beings are weak.
You prayed on that.
I did. I was one of many who did. I did, and I'm ashamed of that fact.
He was sent to a medium security facility in Cumberland, Maryland. When he was released last June, he began working as an accountant at a kosher pizza parlor. Turns out Jack Abramoff was broke, partly because he's paying off nearly $24 million in restitution to the Indian tribes. Today, he lives in his old house in Maryland with his wife, 5 children, and the two Doberman pinchers Mrs. Abramoff bought to protect the family while he was away. After the scandal, Congress instituted a package of reforms, making what Abramoff did, like plying members of Congress with free, expensive meals, illegal. But he doesn't see the new reforms as being very effective.
The reform efforts continually are these faux reform efforts where they'll change, they'll tweak the system, they'll say you can have a meal with a congressman if they're standing up, not sitting down.
Is that serious or are you joking?
Oh, no, I'm not joking.
So it's okay if you pay for lunch as long as you stand up.
Well, it's actually worse than that. You can't take a congressman to lunch for $25 and buy him a hamburger or a steak or something like that, but you can take him to a fundraising lunch and not only buy him that steak, but give him $25,000 extra and call it a fundraiser and have all the same access and all the same interaction with that congressman. So the people who make the reforms are the people in the system.
Could you do the same thing today? I'm asking whether you think the system has been cleaned up.
No, the system hasn't been cleaned up at all. There's an arrogance on the part of lobbyists, and certainly there was on the part of me and my team, that no matter what they come up with, we're smarter than they are, and we'll overcome it. We'll just find another way through. That's all.
He says the most important thing that needs to be done is to prohibit members of Congress and their staff from ever becoming lobbyists in Washington.
If you make the choice to serve the public, public service, and serve the public, not yourself. When you're done, go home. Washington's a dangerous place. Don't hang around.
Former Congressman Bob Ney now works part-time as a radio host. His former chief of staff, Neil Volz, is currently working as a night janitor at a Florida restaurant. And Jack Abramoff has written a memoir called Capital Punishment.
In many places in that video, Leslie Stahl was absolutely appalled about what was going on. She hid her face even when she was interviewing people, other people in their offices. And you probably heard a lot of background noise, sound effect kind of things when they were in the street or in someone's office or in one of the casinos or traffic. So if you can go back and watch that on CBS as one of their archives, and it is online, that would be great. I think it shows you the depth of how we who voted for these people don't have the influence that money and gifts do. And you begin to ask, who's there for us? Who's there for the people? Who's there to do the right thing? And who's there to put money in their pocket? I was recently sent something, I think, Conservative Action Alerts, and it says, it's time for congressional millionaires to finally cut their own pay and end their pension plan. We have to make sacrifices, so they should. A new report says that nearly half of all members of Congress are millionaires, and that number is rising while the rest of the country has gotten poorer. According to a brand new report by the New York Times people, the not-so-exclusive club of Capitol Hill millionaires have grown in recent years to include nearly half of all members of Congress, 250 in all, and the wealth gap between lawmakers and their constituents appear to be growing quickly. At the last count, 10 members of Congress were worth over $100 million. 10 members are worth over $100 million. So why do they need to be bribed by Jack Abramoff? Why do they need more money? You know, I'm reading that, and that's a personal comment from me. I'm going on reading now. While the median net worth of members of Congress jumped 15% from 2004 to 2010, for all other Americans, the rest of us, our median worth dropped 8% based on data from Moody's, M-O-O-D-Y-S, analytics. And if you look back even further, the median wealth of House members grew by 2.5 times between 1984 and 2009, while the wealth of the average American family has actually declined in that same period. And this is according to data from the Washington Post in this article. This is from the article, although it sounds like someone's opinion. And I don't think that all of these rich legislatures came to Congress already rich. Representative Ed Pastor, Democrat, Arizona, held $100,000 or so in a savings account in the mid-1990s and had a retirement pension, but he also owed the bank nearly as much in loans today. He's a millionaire. Today, he's a millionaire. Representative Anna Eshoo, Democrat, California, reported being in debt in 2004. Now she's worth an estimated $1.8 million. You see, once in Congress, members benefit from many financial perks unavailable to most Americans. This is from the article. Based on a base salary of $174,000, an increase of about 10% since 2004, members get extra pay for senior posts and generous medical and pension benefits, as well as accoutrements of power, often financed by taxpayers and their campaigns, and often influenced by lobbyists like Jack Abernoff. It's time for shared sacrifices, and we the people want those folks in Congress to take a pay cut and bring an end to the sweet congressional pension plan. Now, there's also articles out very recently about how the people in Congress are getting tips on Wall Street. They're getting tips before anyone else. So here they are making a killing on Wall Street while we are just sitting here and taking our chances. I guess they depend on us losing money so they can have money. Same thing with the vaccination folks. They don't seem to mind that people are getting sick and dying from vaccinations. Gardasil, way over 100 deaths. I think it's 18,000 and counting. Serious adverse effects. And the same thing is going on. The lobbying that we're talking about, it has become an absolute tragedy because it is now heavily not only into congressional people, but doctors. So the next audio is from Barbara Lowe Fisher, and it's about doctors trying to persuade and fearmonger people into getting vaccinations that are making a lot of people ill and sacrificing, in my opinion, sacrificing our immune system of our entire genetic population.
My name is Barbara Lowe Fisher. My son was injured by DPT vaccine in 1980, and this is a commentary brought to you by the National Vaccine Information Center. It is a short 15-second public service message on the CVS Jumbotron on Times Square in New York City that encourages everyone to make informed vaccine choices. The message is sponsored by the nonprofit charity, the National Vaccine Information Center, and made possible by a donation from Mercola.com. It has been shown hourly since March 22, 2011, alongside much bigger ads for a variety of products marketed by large corporations. On April 13, 2011, the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics sent a letter to CVS containing misinformation about MVIC in an attempt to strong-arm the network into taking the vaccine education message down before it's scheduled to end on April 28. The AAP letter was provided to bloggers who orchestrated an online smear campaign against MVIC and created a petition drive to increase pressure on CBS. Mainstream media outlets like The Guardian in Great Britain republished the AAP's attack and added more disinformation. The American Academy of Pediatrics is a trade association with 60,000 pediatrician members that publishes guidelines for giving vaccines to children. In recent years, the public has learned that the AAP has been taking lots of money from vaccine manufacturers and refusing to disclose to the media just how much money it gets from Big Pharma. In the early 1980s, the AAP lobbied Congress to give pediatricians and drug companies liability protection from vaccine injury lawsuits, while parents of DPT vaccine-injured children worked hard to get vaccine safety and informed consent provisions in the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, which has already paid out more than $2 billion in federal compensation to children and adults harmed by vaccines. Today, when a pediatrician continues to vaccinate a child after the child has experienced vaccine reactions that get worse after each round of shots, that pediatrician is not held liable in a civil court of law when the child ends up brain damaged or dead because of the pediatrician's negligence. This, together with the fact that in February 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court gave drug companies a bigger shield from vaccine injury lawsuits, even if the company could have made a safer vaccine, means that the only power Americans have left to protect ourselves from vaccine injury is to arm ourselves with information and defend the legal right to make vaccine choices in America. But clearly, that is getting harder to do when doctors and organizations paid by the pharmaceutical industry are trying to censor vaccine information and block all public conversation about vaccination, while lobbying to take away the human right to informed consent to medical risk-taking. One of those doctors getting a lot of money from Big Pharma is Dr. Paul Offit. He creates new vaccines and has made a career out of denying vaccine risks and defaming people who disagree with his unscientific opinions, like his cavalier assertion that it would be safe to give a child 10,000 vaccines at once. He delights in spreading misinformation about parents of vaccine-injured children, doctors helping those children, and journalists trying to cover both sides of the vaccine safety debate. Offit spent a large part of his new book demonizing me and MVIC with the half-witted, zealous obsession of a stalker. Just this week, a newspaper in Orange County, California, published a retraction for printing Offit's defamatory accusation that veteran CBS journalist Cheryl Atkinson lied when she accurately reported in 2008 that Offit failed to inform CBS about exactly how much money he and his employer, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, are paid by Merck. Merck is the manufacturer and marketer of Vioxx and a whole slew of vaccines, including Offit's rotavirus vaccine and Gardasil, hepatitis B, chickenpox, shingles, and MMR vaccines. Why should we care about influential doctors who take money from Big Pharma and then spend a lot of their time viciously attacking anyone daring to suggest that vaccines and vaccine policies could be made safer? We should care because doctors don't just ask, but increasingly demand that we trust them with our health and the health of our children. Many pediatricians who are now giving children 6 dozen doses of 16 vaccines starting on the day of birth throw parents out of their office if they dare to ask too many questions about vaccination or ask for fewer vaccines to be given on the same day. While the AAP is promoting the idea that every child must live in a medical home so pediatricians can oversee every child's medical care, including giving children 3 times as many vaccinations as children got 3 decades ago, there are hundreds of new vaccines in the research pipeline. How many of these hundreds of new vaccines being created will be fast-tracked by the FDA and mandated for children as soon as they are licensed? Probably most of them, because that's how drug companies with no liability make big profits, by making sure that every vaccine they make and sell is legally required to be used by every child. And adults are not exempt from the vaccine mandate creep either. Just ask American healthcare workers who are being fired if they don't get an annual flu shot, as well as lots of other vaccines. But what about the children for whom the risks of vaccination are 100%? What about them? Aren't their lives worth saving too? Shouldn't physician organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics be doing everything they can to teach their members about how to be partners with parents in preventing vaccine reactions, instead of throwing families out of their offices and attacking organizations like MVIC, representing families whose loved ones have suffered life-altering vaccine reactions? 30 years ago, when I took my healthy, precocious, 2.5-year-old son into his pediatrician for his 4th DPT shot, I was told nothing about how to recognize a vaccine reaction. He had experienced an extremely severe local reaction after his 3rd DPT shot, but I did not understand the significance of that, and neither did my pediatrician. So another DPT shot was given, and I watched my child suffer a convulsion, collapse, and many hours of unconsciousness shortly after his vaccination, but did not realize he was experiencing a brain inflammation that would change his life and mine forever. Brain inflammation is one of the most feared complications of vaccination and has been since the first vaccines, smallpox and rabies vaccines, were created and given to humans. Doctors have known for more than a century that brain inflammation, whether it is caused by an infection or a vaccination, can cause different kinds of permanent brain dysfunction that ranges from multiple learning disabilities to medication-resistant seizure disorders, mental retardation, and yes, sometimes can result in a constellation of brain dysfunction symptoms that are labeled by doctors as autism. In this book, DPT, A Shot in the Dark, published a quarter century ago, there are many case histories of children whose pediatricians did not tell their mothers about how to recognize the symptoms of vaccine reactions. And those children were revaccinated over and over again until they were permanently brain damaged or died. A number of these children came from families with strong medical histories of allergy and autoimmunity, like my family, a medical history which pediatricians often dismiss as unimportant without any good science to back that belief up. Too often doctors today, just like doctors back in the 1980s, are not telling parents about what to look for after vaccines are given. Too many pediatricians today are listening to the advice of Paul Offit, and instead of adhering to the precautionary principle, are dangerously writing off symptoms of vaccine reactions as a coincidence without having a clue about whether that is true for an individual child. At the National Vaccine Information Center, where we have been collecting information on vaccine reactions since 1982, it is clear to us that more than 50% of all vaccine injuries and deaths could potentially be prevented if doctors and parents were educated about what a vaccine reaction looks like and if pediatricians were much more cautious about revaccinating children when a child gets sicker and sicker after each round of shots. Because your pediatrician may not tell you about how to recognize a symptom of a vaccine reaction, you can download this brochure, If You Vaccinate, Ask 8 Questions, from NVIC's website at www.nvic.org. This brochure contains a list of vaccine reactions to look for, like high-pitched screaming and collapse shock and seizures. At NVIC.org, you can also access vaccine product information published by the vaccine manufacturers and the FDA, as well as do your own research about vaccine reactions reported to the federal government. You can also become more educated about vaccine components with the vaccine ingredient calculator that helps you make informed vaccine choices. And remember, if your child suffers symptoms of marked deterioration in physical, mental, or emotional health after vaccination, you need to make sure your pediatrician writes down those symptoms in the child's permanent medical record. America's children would be better served if the American Academy of Pediatrics leadership educated its membership about how to be intelligent, compassionate partners with parents in preventing vaccine reactions, injuries, and deaths, rather than write off symptoms of vaccine reactions as a coincidence and bully parents into submitting to one-size-fits-all vaccine policies that are not safe for every single child. People are not all the same. We do not all react the same way to pharmaceutical drugs and vaccines. Some children are genetically and biologically at higher risk for suffering life-altering vaccine reactions. Pretending that is not true is both intellectually dishonest and cruel. No child is expendable, and no pediatrician should be encouraged to be a zealous implementer of state vaccine policy first, instead of first doing no harm.
Barbara Lowe Fisher is head of the National Vaccine Information Center.org. She has incredible information on her site. It has all been referenced, and we will post references to the articles that we just used on our Facebook and also on our website. She talks about in that last segment what the problem is. What is it doing to our population? She begs for somebody to help test these kids before these vaccinations happen, and it's falling on deaf ears. Nobody is listening. This next short segment from her tells you why it's happening. Who's ignoring this? Who's ignoring our most precious resource, our kids and their health?
My name is Barbara Lowe Fisher. My son was injured by DPT vaccine in 1980, and this is a commentary brought to you by the nonprofit National Vaccine Information Center. On February 22, 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court shielded drug companies from all liability for harm caused by vaccines mandated by government when companies could have made a safer vaccine. From now on, drug companies selling vaccines in America will not be held accountable by a jury of our peers in a court of law if those vaccines brain damage us but could have been made less toxic. If you get paralyzed by a flu shot, or your child has a serious reaction to a vaccine required for school and becomes learning disabled, epileptic, autistic, asthmatic, diabetic, or mentally retarded, you are on your own. From now on, unless we stand up and draw the line on vaccine mandates, the government can legally use police powers to force every American to get hundreds of vaccinations or be punished, while those who are hurt by vaccination can be more easily swept under the rug and left to fend for themselves. To understand how this happened, we have to turn the clock back to 1982. That is when four big drug companies blackmailed Congress by threatening to stop selling vaccines in America unless a law was passed giving them complete immunity from prosecution. The pharmaceutical industry knew they were in big trouble because the old, crude whooping cough vaccine in the DPT shot was causing brain inflammation and death in many children. The live oral polio vaccine was crippling children and adults with vaccine-strain polio, and Americans were filing lawsuits to hold drug companies responsible for the safety of their products. One day after the Supreme Court blocked lawsuits against drug companies for failing to make vaccines safer, they cleared the way for lawsuits against car manufacturers for failing to make seatbelts safer. Civil liability is a consumer protection. In the past, civil liability has protected us from wealthy tobacco corporations selling cigarettes that were once endorsed by doctors and the U.S. government. Civil liability has protected us from defective cars and toys and food and drugs that have passed federal licensing and safety standards. Civil liability put pressure on drug companies to develop and license a less toxic pertussis vaccine in 1996, and it put pressure on federal health agencies to replace use of a contaminated neurotoxic polio vaccine that can paralyze people with one that cannot. Yes, 30 years ago, the wealthiest and most powerful industry lobbying on Capitol Hill and in state legislatures, the multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical industry, tried very hard to get total liability protection for every vaccine the government regulates, recommends, and mandates. The only difference is that 3 decades ago, government officials were ordering doctors to give children 23 doses of 7 vaccines. And today, that direct order is up to 70 doses of 16 vaccines. The parent co-founders of the National Vaccine Information Center worked with Congress back in the early 1980s, and we refused to support any legislation that would legally let the pharmaceutical industry completely off the hook. Parents successfully argued that if Congress was going to give drug companies partial liability protection through the creation of a federal vaccine injury compensation alternative to a lawsuit, then language had to be written into the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 that protected a citizen's right to sue drug companies when federal compensation was denied or the company had the technological ability to make a vaccine less toxic but refused to do it. Continued civil liability was the safety net for American consumers in that law. Continued civil liability was the leverage that gave some financial incentive to drug companies to make vaccines safer and gave some political incentive to government officials to award federal compensation to the vaccine injured. Now, six activist Supreme Court judges have ripped the liability safety net from the U.S. mass vaccination system and written Big Pharma a blank check by deliberately ignoring the language and legislative history of the 1986 Vaccine Injury Act. Only Supreme Court Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg, in an accurate and brilliant dissenting opinion, stood up for the people. Now it will be much easier for employees in government health agencies and the U.S. Department of Justice and the Vaccine Court to deny vaccine victims federal compensation, which 308 million Americans pay for through a surcharge on each one of the annual flu shots and the dozens of doses of vaccines public health officials say we all should get. There is $3 billion waiting to be awarded in the Vaccine Injury Trust Fund, which has already been raided by federal agencies dragging vaccine victims through years of litigation and looking for ways to deny vaccine risks.
You've heard this appalling, horrible information about how our kids' health is being taken over by people who can't be seeing our children as human beings. They're being seen as money-making guinea pigs. And the only way these laws could have been passed is through some kind of lobbying and peddling influence from our legislatures. There is something right now that just came through, the National Defense Authorization Act. It's been adopted, it's been accepted, it's been voted on by the people that we elected who pledged to uphold our Constitution and our laws. Now, the Fifth Amendment says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, property, pursuit of happiness without due process. But this bill allows the detention and torture of American citizens on U.S. soil without access to a trial or an attorney, without any formal charges being brought. This is very similar to what Barbara Lowe Fisher is talking about. These laws were passed by our Congress people. Now, it doesn't say in the Constitution that Congress people need to protect our children. But they had to know what they're doing when they did this law, National Defense Authorization Act. We can't do much about the laws that have already been passed, except recall these people, get a new Congress. My own senator from Ohio, Republican Robert Portman, voted in favor of this National Defense Authorization Act that allows policemen to come to my house and drag me out of here, shoot me full of immunizations because I'm going to a jail where there's people, and hold me without a trial, without a lawyer, without anything, because they could say I'm a domestic terrorist because I'm saying things against immunizations, and therefore I'm saying something against the country. What they don't report is people like Jack Abernoff and how they have been compromised. Robert Portman, in the article that I just read about this, reported by the writer from the Business Insider, David Seaman, that Portman received $272,852 from special interest groups that backed this bill. Why would any congressman in their right mind pass a bill, vote for a bill that is directly against the Constitution? They are sworn in by the Constitution that they will uphold the Constitution. Now, Montana has already started proceedings to recall their people who voted for this National Defense Authorization Act. This is our opportunity to get people in there who will repeal this vaccination crap, that will repeal this national security, homeland security that's allowing this to happen. Only 9 states have this recall on the books. And New Jersey was just kicked out, saying the states don't have a right to do this. Somebody ought to go against that. Arizona, Colorado, Louisiana, Michigan, Nevada, Montana, North Dakota, Oregon, and Wisconsin can withdraw their support of their Congress people. Let's use this opportunity, this National Defense Authorization Act, to get in touch with each of our representatives. And you can go online and look it up about congressional voting. Who voted? How did your people vote for the National Detention Authorization Act? It's often done with NDAA. Let's ask each of them how they can justify voting for a bill that defies the Constitution. These politicians from both parties have betrayed our trust. They've violated their oaths that they took to defend the Constitution. It's not the left or the right here. It's about our Bill of Rights. And without that Bill of Rights, there is no America. It's the crown jewel of our Constitution and the high watermark of Western civilization. Contact our office. We'll try to help you through this. Phone number 740-698-9119. Or just write to me, Sherry On Air. Sherry, S-H-A-R-R-Y, On Air at gmail.com. We'll get this done. We're just at the beginning of this. We really don't know what we're doing. We really need to contact Montana and see how they're doing it. And then let's follow along. This has been a tremendous show about our rights and how they're being stepped on, mutilated. Let's go back to the people who have been compromised. Let's get people in there that are above this. And we, the people, can call them on this. I want to be part of this change. I want to be part of making it better. I'm not going to stand by and watch. I'm going to get up and do. And that's what I'm asking you folks to do. To get up and do and make a difference for the future. And thank you for joining us. It's wonderful that you're here. Maybe you didn't listen to this show live because it's on holiday. I couldn't believe that over 700 of you listened to the recording from last week's show. Thank you for being here. Thanks for listening.
I am happy to close the show by saying that currently the Patriot Act has been stalled, and I say stalled because we know they're going to go back in and poke at it and possibly come up with another name for it and call it something else and then, you know, redo something. But that currently the Senate did not reauthorize the U.S. Patriot Act and also failed to pass the USA Freedom Act, which would reform the NSA's bulk collection. So they're just stalling on everything. So there's shuffling of papers going on. But at least it's stalled for now. Not that anything's changed, but there's, you know, a vision that maybe something could happen. All right, everybody, have a great weekend. Have a good Memorial Day. See you Tuesday. Not sure what we're talking about. Bye.